Welcome to Week, the Commonwealth Club's Political Roundtable for Monday, April 13th, 2015. Thanks for joining us here in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for Week to Week. Now, on today's program, we're going to talk about the big political announcement this week. I'm sure you can guess what that was, as well as some other big political news. We'll also talk about California's water politics, President Obama's international agenda, some conservative legislative momentum in the states, and more. So, as usual, any opinions that are expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Unless you agree with them, then we take total responsibility for it. Now, let's meet our candidates for today. Let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the other end of the stage with Carson Bruno. He's a research fellow at Hoover Institution, where he specializes in California policy and politics. Next to him is Molly Riley, the Huffington Post deputy politics editor. And Melissa Griffin Kane is a contributor to CBS SF, where you can catch her Mornings with Melissa segments. She's also an attorney, and they're all on Twitter. We encourage you to follow them. There are also question cards spread throughout the room. Write down some questions and submit them. I will do my best to ask as many of them as possible. Now, on to our roundtable. This week, we got a major political candidate throwing their hat in the ring.
Marco Rubio,
that's right. But before that, trying to steal his thunder, of course, was former Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. Let's talk about this, and Molly, I'm going to start with you. What do we know about her likely campaign from, you know, what the campaign is saying so far and what she's actually done so far?
Well, I think for Hillary, some of the big challenges are setting this campaign apart from her 2008 campaign. And there's this whole aura around her of inevitability. Everyone's known that she's been running for, 8 years now, even more. You know, her husband was president. She's been in the public eye for a long time as Secretary of State. And she's been the clear Democratic frontrunner and is the Democratic frontrunner for a long time. So I think she needs to kind of reinforce that she needs people to still turn out for her because she's not just going to get elected on her own. And I think you saw that with her announcement video yesterday. I don't know how many of you watched it, but it was fun waiting for that, how I spent my Sunday. But, you know, she really put people first in the video. She wasn't in the video herself until a minute and a half in. And leading up to her saying that she was running, it was, you know, showing, you know, kind of all the classic Democratic campaign motifs. It was very diverse. You know, there was a Hispanic couple, a Black couple, a gay couple, there were Spanish speakers. You know, it was really addressing all kinds of walks of life in the Democratic Party. And then she said, you know, here I am and I want to earn your vote. And I think that earn your vote was really telling for Hillary. She's kind of acknowledging that people think she has it in the bag and she wants to show that she is going to work for it.
Carson, what was your impression when you saw that rollout? I mean, I saw the video. I thought it was a very smooth video. I mean, it was a well-done video. Does that tell us anything, or does it just tell us she's hired some good ad people? I mean,
she's had quite a while to put together this 2 minute or 2.5 minute video. So you hope that it would be good when they actually released it. You know, what's interesting for me is, and really going back onto a few of the points there, is she is, in a way, having to run away from 2008, because they made a lot of mistakes then. And what they could fall into is actually over-planning their overness of trying to stay away from 2008. And I saw glimpses of that. A rationale for running for president. It tripped up Ted Kennedy back in the 70s. She really didn't have a rationale in 2008. And I think they're still struggling with figuring out why she should be president. She talked about earning the vote. She talked about the middle income, about, you know, helping people with their income inequality and all these issues. But is she really the best messenger for an income inequality or, you know, helping the middle class sort of message? She might struggle there. And if she's running a primary campaign, she could alienate the general election electorate. If she decides to run a general election campaign from day one, then she's not really going to get the Democratic base all revved up that a real hot campaign like you saw in 2008 would do. So there's a lot to be seen still. Especially, especially when we go into Iowa, New Hampshire, where she is planning to go in the next few weeks. So. Yeah.
About it. So she comes out and she says, I want to work for America's families. And in the video, there are all these families and there's couples of all different sort of, you know, sizes and shapes. And there's not a single member of her family in this video. There's no Bill, there's no grandbaby, there's no Chelsea in this video. But and it's so interesting to see that as juxtaposed to the 2008 video, where if you may recall, she's sitting on a fancy couch with pictures behind her, like, welcome to my home. I'm gonna run. You know, so she seemed to sort of try to be, she's clearly trying to be more accessible. I think that that's clear. But, you know, when we talk about trying to get, how do you get the base fired up? The base doesn't get fired up for people as much as they do against people. So for the most part, a lot of what we're going to see about Hillary's campaign is going to be based on who the Republican nominee is. And trying to predict how she's going to maneuver up until that point is very difficult to do. Although as the only sort of, you know, serious Democratic candidate right now, she does, to your point, not only have 8 years to put together a video, but she's got the best team, you know, whatever dream team of consultants that you could possibly put together from the Democratic side, she's got. So we're going to see now sort of this awesome Frankenstein campaign monster that I'm very excited about. It should be pretty polished. It should be great.
I think it's interesting. I remember back in the 92 campaign, so I guess it would have been like 91, where everyone was holding their breath, waiting for the inevitable candidate who was Mario Cuomo, New York's governor. You know, everyone expected him to run in 88 and 92. He did not, but because he went back and forth and back and forth, he kind of cleared the field out of some people who would have thrown in. So by the time he said no, it actually allowed the second-tier candidates, including the certain Arkansas governor, Bill Clinton, to get traction that they might not have had if, you know, there had been, you know, a strong one of the A-list folks. And, you know, Bill Clinton really took it and ran with it and really, you know, he loves campaigning. So obviously a fight was something he was really into. What I think is interesting about a couple things I've heard here is kind of the idea that they're looking back at the 2008 campaign as if it was a flop. She didn't win. She came close to winning. I mean, that was an amazing campaign. You know, and it was an exciting campaign. Almost whichever side you were on in that primary, I mean, both of those two top candidates, they got better as that went on, and it became a very dramatic thing. Kind of to what Carson was saying, I wonder, where the mistakes will be made in trying not to do stuff that probably wasn't wrong in the first place.
They spent a lot of time focused on the primary states and not the caucus states, and the Obama team really understood the mechanics of the primary a lot better than it seemed like the Clinton group did. And realistically, she probably won't have to deal with that because there isn't a Barack Obama waiting in the wings. And more importantly, there's not a John Edwards waiting in the wings also. You know, without John Edwards, she probably would have won Iowa on that day. So you don't really know how it will all play out. You have to have both of them. It's just not Obama in the 2008 situation.
Now, there's also talk within there are lots of articles being written right now about, you know, the machinations within the campaign, what their plans are. There's talk of this being a no drama campaign. Of course, we that's a phrase we got from the Obama administration. But Melissa, what are the chances of this being a no drama?
I hope not. That would be really boring. That would make an even a boring Democratic primary even more boring. We're going to need some high-profile departures. You can't have that many egos in a room and not have something happen. I hope, especially since, you know, she is inevitably the Democratic candidate, at least, that there is something going on. There have to be disagreements, especially going forward when you're trying to shape up and see, again, who your Republican adversary is. Part of the problem with this idea that, you know, and I'm sure she would disagree, at the idea that she should have an opponent in the primary, right? Not many monopolists want to just invite more people on in to the field. But here's the other problem, and I don't know how she deals with it, frankly. I had, you know, when I write and people leave mean things in the comments, it makes me sad. Like, I don't know how she gets up in the morning with some of the things that are out there in the Twitter sphere. But the idea that if she's the only candidate, and there is no other candidate, not really, that she's the thing and the person that they get to beat up on. Every Republican candidate gets to use her as a punching bag and try to, especially ones who are vying for a vice president, like Carly Fiorina, get to just spend all day long hammering away at her because they know she's the one. So in addition to making her tougher and in addition to making her more poised to do well in debates and things like that further down the line, part of, you know, there is a huge drawback to being the inevitable Democratic candidate, and that is you are just this enormous punching bag for Republican candidates and their supporters and the internet and all the horrible people on it. Mentally, I think that would be, again, an extremely tough, she's a tough lady, way tougher than me, but I think that's something else to take into consideration when you think about what would be helped if there was somebody, anybody, who could sort of draw some attention away from her.
Molly, there's talk of this being a $1.5 to $2 billion Clinton campaign. Obviously, it's going to be a similar number than on the Republican side, at least. What do people make of that? I was going to say,
that's kind of how it is now, which is sad and depressing, but, you know, we're, what, 18 months out from the general, and that's a long time to be running ads, and, you know, she doesn't get the Democratic money until the convention in 2016. So that's, you know, a whole year pretty much of running on your own funds. I think this morning the campaign asked fundraisers to each raise $27,000 in the next month was the goal.
$27,000? That's all?
But it's like, you know, 10 donors each, you know, if each donor can get 10 more donors, that kind of thing. But, you know, the Clinton donor base is huge. I think it's just the reality of a modern political campaign, especially starting out this early.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested in what the Wall Street factor is going to be in all of this. You know, Hillary has always had the backing of Wall Street to an extent. She was New York senator. You know, Bill Clinton was president during sort of the heyday of all of this. And that kind of puts her in a tough position with winning over progressives. You know, I think that's why Ready for Warren has been such a vocal force, if not effective, in getting Elizabeth Warren to jump in the race. You know, that's a tough thing for the left to swallow, is her connections to Wall Street. But their money is definitely going to be part of her campaign.
Paul Krugman, I think it was in today's paper, New York Times, was saying basically after financial reform and such, a lot of Wall Street pretty much has totally gone over to the Republican Party. You know, what do you think about that? That's not going to be an issue, perhaps, or that she'll be able to make more space between herself and them because she's not going to expect big money from them anyway.
There's still a lot of money there.
Yeah.
I mean, on for the Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be that they're moving, you know, to the Republicans, but there's still enough money to go around. And, you know, it's something that she's going to have to do because, you know, Obama and Romney ran $1 billion campaigns 4 years ago, so it's only to be expected that each election is going to get more and more expensive, especially adding super PACs into the equation. And that might be where you see a lot of the Wall Street money really going, less so into her campaign and more so into her allies' campaign or allies' organizations.
Isn't that crazy, though?
Like $2 billion campaign. Oh my God! I was reading. Lyndon Johnson ran like the most expensive campaign, the most expensive Senate campaign in Texas, back in like 1948, and he had $40,000. Now you can adjust that for inflation, but it is not $1 billion. I mean, it is so bananas. Now in California, especially, we see crazy billionaires try to fund themselves and, you know, lose all the time. So, I mean, it's no big deal to, you know, just because you have a ton of money doesn't mean you're going to win. We know that in California. You can still totally lose. But I mean, can we officially retire the idea that anyone can be president? That anyone can grow up and be president. I mean, if it was ever true, it may not have ever been true. It certainly isn't now when we're talking about no one is even batting an eye at a $1 billion campaign, at a $2 billion campaign, and what that means for where that money has to come from is just, I think that, and by the way, just from a legal nerdy perspective, the Citizens United left open some questions about what's legal and what's not. So I think after this campaign, you might see some lawsuits that are going to take some time to get up to the Supreme Court. But there may be some loopholes for super PACs and sort of special committees that get closed. Hopefully, will get closed after this because we actually are in this in a sort of a funky gray area with some of these leadership PACs and things like that will hopefully get settled out and may actually provide a little bit of relief, but I'm not sure, how much.
Have to be decided in the courts, or is there bipartisan agreement?
You're so funny. No.
I aim to enter point Dane.
No. Okay. There's only a... Nope. That would have to be a court thing, I think.
Well, so before we start talking about some of the Republicans, just very quickly, we touched on Elizabeth Warren. She says she's not running, and then the next day she changes her story and says she's not running. And, the next time she's asked, she comes up with a completely different thing, which is she's not running. Is there anything you think that would make her run? Should people just drop that, or do you think she might... People had thought that she might do it in order to push Clinton to take more of these positions about the middle class and economic... But if Clinton is basing her campaign on, middle class and income inequality... Can we take Elizabeth Warren at her word? Anybody?
I think so. Yeah. Honestly.
Hillary completely imploded and there was some awful thing that came out. I don't think there's any reason she would. Why would she? What does she have to she's not going to beat Hillary. So what would she gain from it? And I think she's in a position in the Senate that is really great for her and she's, influential there, and she gets a lot of press, and I think she's in a good spot, and I think she can influence the election and what Hillary's message is without jumping in the race herself.
And look, historically speaking, as we all know, once a party is sort of held on for two terms, it is unlikely, as much as, a lot of people love Hillary, it is unlikely, at least, again, historically, that you're going to win that next election, so why not keep your powder dry, keep your name good in everyone's mind, and don't be that person that just lost to Hillary. Be that savior who can come in 2020, run then, should Hillary lose, which again, historically she might, and now she can come in and sort of ride the white stallion in, and the path would be very clear for her. So I can totally understand her political calculation, and aside from the fact that I like her, I do believe her when she says no, I'm not running. But I get why she's not. She doesn't. There, to your point, there's really no upside for her at this point.
Influential in the Senate, to be honest. When you run for president, you're going to have to start making decisions and making positions on a whole host of things that she wouldn't really have to touch that could really kind of take her brand in a different direction. She stays in the Senate, stays a policy person, stays, the middle-class champion in the Democratic caucus, and she continues to be a massive influence in the entire party without having to run a presidential campaign.
Well, speaking of having to take interesting positions when you run for the president, let's talk about another candidate who has announced, and that is Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. He's frankly gotten off to a rough start in his campaign. I mean, the only news stories you see about him these days are him walking out on interviews or getting into, tiffs with his interviewers. Melissa, is this what his campaign is about right now? I mean, will he be able to overcome that, or is he always going to be defined by walking off the Guardian's interview?
Well, I mean, he's going to have to get it together, right? I mean, of course, hopefully he's in a hotel suite somewhere with some very smart crisis managers, like Sam Singer's in there, like Olivia Pope is in there, like they're all in there helping him to get it together. He could salvage it. Look, there's no real way he's going to be elected. I'm sorry, people who love him, it's not really viable. There's really not a path unless something truly horrible happened to all the other candidates. He's not really a front runner to be elected, but he could still save his name and keep his campaign from totally going down the tubes if he were able to practice maybe with some lady friends, some questions. But some of these things are really basic. On his website, he was selling Rand Paul flip-flops, actual flip-flops that you could buy. And so right after the Samantha Guthrie thing, they quickly went on there and were like, Rand Paul sandals. They're sandals. They're not flip-flops anymore. Okay, Rand Paul. But it just means what politician sells flip-flops on their site? After the Kerry campaign, This is what you do. So clearly, look, running for Senate in Kentucky and running for president are not the same thing. And clearly he needs to, you know, ratchet up the A game, because right now, as one of the only three candidates, he really is under the spotlight. It's only going to get harder and harder for him to get attention. So, of course, it's important that he really rein that in, you know, sort of pretty quickly and get himself back on track.
Carson, part of the reason a lot of folks have been attracted to Rand Paul, including people like Bill Maher, who, you know, gave $1 million to Barack Obama, but he's saying, you know, they're attracted to Rand Paul because he's a libertarian. He has a reputation for, you don't, might not like what I'm going to say, but this is what I believe. And to some people, it's non-threatening, or you might, you know, think, oh, well, it's an interesting thing for a Republican to say, or that's crazy, but you know what, he's open-minded or something. But when he starts shifting positions, that seems to have damaged that attraction these people have. What can he do, or what should he do?
Well, this is what happens when you try to please everyone. I mean, he's trying to hold on to his father's electoral base, which is quite substantial in many of the early states, which could really, you know, kind of kick off his campaign. But at the same time, it's not big enough to win the nomination. So you have to grow it. So once he starts growing it, which means he's going to have to start taking positions that his father would never dream of, and that he probably was on the record, you know, up against at one point. So it's bound to happen with a candidacy like his. You know, he's too liberal for most Republicans, especially on the foreign policy issues, but also he's too conservative, especially on the social issues, for most libertarians and then also liberals and Democrats. So he's trying to be something to everyone, and that just doesn't win you votes at the end of the day. So he's going to struggle because he doesn't really know what his identity is and where he's going to fit in. 2 years ago, he knew what his identity was and where he would fit in. But once you start getting the consultants telling you what you need to do and how do you get to, you know, 30% in Iowa, which is what you will likely need to win, or, you know, whatever it is, 25%, 40% in New Hampshire, then you start to kind of start wiggling around, and then you start to look like a fool on news.
Now, on that survey out there, we noticed one person voted for Ted Cruz. I'm pretty sure that was you, Molly, right? So what do we know about Ted Cruz's campaign right now? It's not getting much attention, except that we learned that he's got this big billionaire backer. Does that make him a player?
Well, I think, you know, Cruz is very far to the right, and I don't think he can really expand. The people who like Ted Cruz are going to vote for Ted Cruz, and I'm not sure how much he can expand beyond that. But he is, you know, he's out there. He's making a name for himself. He's kind of been doing that for 2 years in the Senate now. You know, he's building his profile, and, you know, that's something that he can come back to in 2020. You know, I think he's staying out of it a little bit. You know, I think he's probably seen what's happened to Rand Paul, and you know he's been a little bit out of the media since announcing. But you know, I think, you know, he'll be kind of like, you know, in 2012 we had a lot of Republicans running, and, you know, they all got book deals and they all got a lot of press, and they've built a profile for themselves, and I think that's what Cruz is doing too. I don't see him really being a challenge to someone like Jeb Bush or even Scott Walker or even Rubio.
I should point out that the number I heard of possible Republican candidates for president in 2016 was up to 20. So they will have to build an extra long state. It's like a San Francisco mayoral race.
When you after 2012, after 2008 actually, but definitely after 2012, there is this idea among, and I say this because I attended the Republicans. I like to attend Republican state conventions because I have a very weird sense of fun, but they're great, and some of my best friends are Republicans. But you go, and there was always the sense that the problem was the evangelicals didn't vote. They didn't turn out. That's the problem. It wasn't that we, you know, gave it our best shot and people just disagreed with us. No. There was this silent mass of evangelicals who didn't vote. And this is something that a lot of Republicans, not all, but a lot of Republicans truly believe. And so what's interesting about Cruz is he has the potential to be the guy, right? He could prove or disprove this theory, right? If the theory is there are millions of evangelicals who just didn't come out to vote because they didn't like Mitt Romney, you know, sort of disproving this, why should we go with that, you know, moderate guy? Ted Cruz can actually be that sort of that touchstone, and sort of, and so you can see, you know, whether he does well or does or doesn't do well, he could be, you know, that number one guy. The problem, though, is of course we still got Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee, who did well in Iowa and New Hampshire, and you know, in 2012, who are now in it again, and so they may split the evangelical vote. I think they're all looking to consolidate around somebody, and I think it might be Ted Cruz. A lot of former Santorum supporters are looking to him. So we have like a test case now to see whether it really is the case that there's this silent majority out there who just wasn't showing up for Mitt Romney. And that's what I think is going to be so interesting about Ted Cruz's numbers, is they can actually, you know, prove or challenge that theory that many people in the Republican Party still have.
So it's a $4 billion presidential election, but it's just an experiment for Melissa just to see what's really going to happen.
What will be interesting to see is Ted Cruz at the first Republican debate, which I think is going to be held here in California at the Reagan Library. I think they're slotted for the first one. He's going to be up there on a stage with, I hope not 20 people, because that's just a circus. But he's going to be up there with a lot of senators and governors who have major accomplishments behind them in their time in office. And he doesn't have any. Not really. He has a shutdown, which I really don't think many Republicans even view that as an accomplishment anymore. So it's going to be troubling for him when he gets up there. And he has really nothing to talk about why he should be the nominee when everyone else is going to be rattling off list after list after list of things that they have done to further the conservative movement. It's going to be hard for him to really maintain momentum.
Before we move on to non-presidential politics, today we did have another announcement, and that was Florida Senator Marco Rubio announcing that he is running. What do we think about him? What part of the Republican coalition does he go after?
Impressive speech. To be honest, he knew what he had to get done, and he got it done. And I think the best thing that happened to him was Hillary Clinton announcing yesterday, because his speech was really designed, I think, really to bracket himself against Jeb Bush in this new generation, not yesteryear, but the future. But it works just as much, if not better, with the Clintons. So he has a message. He understands where he's going. The problem is, for him, Bush is running and Scott Walker has been doing very well in the polls and with donors and with the grassroots. And so where does he really fit in there? He's going to have to go after Walker. He can't really go after Bush. Bush has the moderate to liberal Republicans kind of locked down at this point.
His former mentor.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very closely connected, and now they're rivals.
So what Rubio needs to do is become the alternative to Bush, and it means going after the somewhat conservative group, Republican establishment, Tea Party kind of coalition that Walker seems to be doing well right now with. It definitely could happen. Walker's not by any means locked in that number two spot.
Okay. Well, let's talk about, again, California water politics. As we mentioned last time here, California Governor Jerry Brown has issued the first ever mandatory water conservation rules for the state, implementing a hoped for 25% reduction in water use through February of 28 in next year, 2016. So does anyone want to, is anyone excited about these rules? Because I might be wrong on this. I mean, I have heard that San Francisco actually is in a better position than a lot of places across the state because it already does quite a bit for conserving water and recycling and stuff like that. But when we get into the issues of, Carson, I think you have some info on this too. The statistic I saw is that agriculture is something like just 2% of the state's economy, but it uses 80% of the water. That's what the Washington Post says. I mean, that's huge.
It's leading, and here's why. It's because the environmental protection component of California's water allotment is taken out of agricultural's use. And so the 80% includes environmental and then commercial agricultural uses. And so when you really kind of break it down by the three major uses, which is environmental protection, urban uses, and then agricultural uses, you're looking at about 50% environmental protection, 40% agriculture, and then 10% for the rest with urban uses. So it's still agriculture is still substantial, you know, four times, sure. us here in this room, you know, just using water for our showers and drinking water and et cetera. But that 50% component is really the tricky part, because the system wasn't designed for environmental use or environmental protection use at all. When the system was built in the 60s, 70s, A, it was built for a population of 17 million. We're now a little bit bigger than that, and growing. And the system hasn't been updated since, I think, Jerry Brown shut down it in his first term in, what was that, probably 76. So Republican governors, Democratic governors have really done nothing to prepare us for a situation like this. And now everyone's trying to play catch-up in Sacramento, and they're not really doing the catch-up that they need to be doing.
In case you're wondering what the governor wants you to do, this is according to the California State Water Resources Control Board, which for most of you, you've just learned that we have such a thing. So everybody, regardless of where they are, they're no longer supposed to use, is it potable or potable water? Potable, thank you. Clean, we'll just say. They're not supposed to use that for washing sidewalks or driveways. They are not supposed to have runoff when they're irrigating with clean water. They're not supposed to use hoses without shutoff nozzles when they're washing their car. So I just never wash my car, so way ahead. You're not supposed to use it for like decorative water features that do not recirculate the water, so it's reusing it. And you're not supposed to do outdoor irrigation during and 48 hours following any measurable precipitation. So that's what you're all not going to be doing. Businesses, now when you go into a restaurant, you're not supposed to be given any water unless you ask for it. Hotels and motels have to give you the option of not having your linens and towels washed every day. I remember a hotel that really, I think they were already ahead of their time because they... Those are the main things, and frankly, it doesn't sound draconian. I mean, it's not like the Holiday Inn letting the towels go stale a day or so is going to really bring in that 25%. I guess that's my whole impression. It's like, I don't get it. That 25% is actually a huge amount.
Here's also the problem that the state of California really, they haven't done much to retrofit a lot of the older homes and businesses to have water meters. And so I believe it's something like 10 water districts out there, which isn't that many. I mean, we have lots of water districts in the state. But 10 have absolutely no water meters in them at all. So even if the state water board comes to them and says, hey, look, you need to reduce yours by 35%, there's no way for them to know how much they're doing, how much they're using right now, let alone then how much to reduce, you know, back down. So until the water meters really get into effect, and the state law only mandates... So everything prior to 1992, after 1992 that was built in the state had to have a water meter built with it. Everything prior to that, they have it up until 2025 to get a water meter added onto their home or business.
It's drought by then.
And that doesn't even count all the apartments that each individual unit don't have a water meter, and they don't have to have water meters. So myself, you know, I live in an apartment down in Mountain View. I have no clue how much water I use. So how am I supposed to be able to... you know, do my part in it, and let alone how are the police then supposed to enforce it? So there's some problems there with the Jerry Brown's plan.
Someone in the audience asked the question, and I hadn't heard this, but Carly Fiorina apparently says it is Democrats who are to blame for the drought. Well, because they wouldn't build dams, and it kind of goes to when you're in power, you kind of have to take, you know, the hits for the big decisions that were not made.
We have Republican governors too who weren't building the storage. You know, California only captures about 25% of the water, the precipitation that drops onto California. The rest of it either goes through evaporation or plants, you know, use it, or it runs off back into the ocean. So there's a lot of water that California could be capturing still. It just they haven't been rebuilding the reservoirs, digging the reservoirs deeper since the 70s. So it's hard to blame it on any one individual, one administration, because Pete Wilson didn't do it, George McMasian didn't do it, Gray Davis, Schwarzenegger, and now Brown again. So it's hard.
I was talking to my mother on the phone yesterday. She lives in Wisconsin, where they're very protective of the Great Lakes. And there is, it's kind of like a rumor out there, like, you know, that Obama was born in Kenya or something. Everyone in the Great Lakes thinks that California wants to ship their water out here, despite the fact that it would be prohibitively expensive, blah, blah, blah. So I was gently telling her no one's talking about that. But then she said something that I think someone in here, in fact, just said, which is, what about desalinization? See, I'm asking you for all the language stuff. I won't even tell you what my title is here. Is that a possibility? I mean, are there technical problems to it? Is it cost? Why aren't we doing that?
Energy. You know, if you're talking about cutting back on using fossil fuels and energy, that is a huge, huge use of energy to desalinize water. So I think you're kind of, you know, fighting fire with fire in that case.
Put a nuclear power plant right next to every single one of them, and we're not doing that anytime soon. So,
you know, it's, you know, playing the blame game and looking backwards is really not productive at this point. The damage has been done. The groundwater is, you know, really depleted to scary levels, and it would take hundreds of years of rainwater to replenish that. So kind of what Brown needs to be looking at and businesses in the state is, how do we develop in a way that conserves water? How do we save the water that we still have? You know, things like building with gray water systems, you know, mandating that new homes don't have lawns, farming, like how, you know, a lot of farmers in agriculture has already adopted irrigation systems that use less water because they've had water cuts for years now. But getting that on a wider scale, you know, is that something that we can do?
Okay.
I think in San Francisco there's already a rule that you can't have lawns, I'm pretty sure.
We have lawns.
Sure. Like, just from what I've seen.
Yes.
I'm right? From looking.
Okay. Well, let's talk a bit about international politics, which is not our usual thing here, but that's pretty much what President Obama is doing for these final 2 years. And he's got a couple very big initiatives right now up in the air. He was just in Panama at the Summit of the Americas, I believe it's called, where all these Western Hemisphere leaders were gathered. He was meeting with Raul Castro, the president of Cuba. And of course, recently it was announced that the P+5, the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany, I love Germany, but I don't know why they're in there, they've been negotiating with Iran to try to prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon or getting to that level. Both of these are huge things. They would be reversals of decades of, you know, antagonism and animosity. How much is he going to get to do? How much is, well, the Republican Congress going to prevent him from doing? You know, is he more likely to get what he wants on Cuba than on Iran, or are these both just red lines for his opponents? Anybody? Carson, I'm going to throw that to you.
You're welcome. Thank you. If I had to pick between the two of them, I think you get more on Cuba. Because there is, I think actually the opening up of Cuba is a great idea. It's something that we should have done decades ago. You know, the best way to turn someone pro-Western, pro-American is to just flood them with American tourists and money. To show them what markets do, what capitalism can do for you, to really kind of to show them what they're missing out, really. And
they could be hosting spring break. I mean,
they could be, yeah. They'd be making a lot of money too, you know. So I think that one, there's quite a few Republicans in the House and in the Senate who'd be willing to kind of go there. Marco Rubio is definitely going to make it a major point of his campaign, but that's not surprising, given his background and, you know, where he really grew up and got a start, and his parents and his history. Iran, I don't see much happening on that, mainly because he has a lot of opposition from within Democrats on Capitol Hill. And so if he can't convince his own people to go along with it, why would any Republican go along with it also? So he's going to struggle there.
Molly, do you expect, now that Hillary Clinton is the presumptive nominee, let's call her. Well, maybe not even that. She's the leading candidate on the Democratic side, the only one at the moment. She's going to be constantly having these questions thrown to her. You know, what will you do with the Iran deal and if you take office? You know, will you, we assume a Republican would try to reverse it. What would you do? Are those kind of unwanted hot potatoes to have to deal with at a fledgling campaign?
Well, I think what's interesting is you kind of forget this now because it's so long ago, but foreign policy was a big reason why Obama surged ahead of Hillary. Iraq was huge. And Obama was asked about, you know, whether he would negotiate with Ahmadinejad, and he said yes. And that's something that Hillary criticized him about. So I think she's going to have to answer to that for sure if she's, you know, coming out in support of the Iran deal. And she has come out in support of it. You know, I think, but going back to 2008, I think this is sort of Obama making good on a lot of his campaign promises. He's sort of building this foreign policy legacy, you know, promoting peace in Iran, opening up Cuba with China and cutting back emissions and the climate change accord there. So these are all things that are, you know, they're making his legacy look good. Whether or not they'll be able to continue to look good, depending on what Republicans do, is another question. With Iran, Bob Corker has a bill that will basically require any deal that goes through to be approved by Congress, and Chuck Schumer, who is the likely successor to Harry Reid, is in favor of that bill. So that looks likely to pass in the Senate. So yeah, you know, I think it's kind of a mixed bag for Hillary for sure.
Here's the thing. I mean, the thing about the Iran deal is that it's a framework. Right. We don't really have specifics. So they're going to ask her the question, well, what do you think about the Iran deal? And she's going to be like, I think it's worth talking about. Like, you're not going to get her to nail down any, like, pro or con without any specifics. So it's just specific enough to get everybody mad, but it's not specific enough to that anyone wants to be attached to it. Right. So it's a mess. Like, what a horrible thing to have to answer as a candidate. But it's not just her. Republican candidates as well are going to have to answer these questions. But it's going to be a mealy mouth question. It's going to be a little blah, blah, blah question. It's not going to be very specific because the thing isn't very specific. But I totally agree with Carson. Like, Cuba, nobody's really opposed to it. Well, there's a small, very dedicated group of people opposed to it, and we in San Francisco know what that's like. That can be very, very powerful sometimes. But literally, like, 85% of Americans is fine with Cuba opening up. And so in terms of effectuating the stuff that other people already want to happen, yes, you know, like, he's going to be great at that. But in terms of bringing like the Iran deal down to the ground, I'm not sure that's going to happen during his presidency. It might be something that he sort of leaves on the desk as a gift for the next administration. But in terms of his legacies, one is definitely different from the other. One is just far more accepted. But you do have faith that he'll get it done. Because, you know, if everyone's on board, he can definitely make that happen once he's kind of got the mandate, and he does seem to have that. The other, again, it's going to be a mess for the candidates, but you're never going to be able to pin them down on one way or the other.
Okay. A question about trade deals, you know, free trade deals, and that's been bandied about sometimes as something that Barack Obama would be able to get kind of cross-party support. I don't know if that means actual bipartisan support or just Democratic president working with Republican majority, but any thoughts on that? Is that maybe the one area that he'll be able to get Republican majority support in Congress?
I think so. I think, though, for Republicans, it would have to be led by Congress, not really coming from him or from the State Department. Yeah, yeah. For optics, it's politics.
Okay.
But, you know, actually the more interesting on that point is Ron Wyden up in Oregon. There's a lot of talk about the left really going after him in the primary because he is very supportive of the fast-tracked sort of movement when it comes to free trade deals. So that would be the interesting thing, to see if there's kind of like this semi-progressive type Tea Party movement that kind of flourishes up on this issue amongst certain Democrats throughout the country. It's possible. Wyden, I think, is pretty safe, but who knows what could happen.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our next topic, which is really some major conservative legislation that has been passed in the states. And if you've been paying attention to the gubernatorial races and the various state houses, the state legislatures and such across the country, you know that right now it's pretty strong majority of them that are controlled by the GOP. And we started to see them pass some bills that frankly have been dreams of populist conservatives for years. We saw the Indiana, last week, or 2 weeks ago actually, when last time we were here, we talked about the Indiana Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and Indiana Governor Mike Pence subsequently got his legislature to clarify that, no, this isn't intended to discriminate. That actually helped Arkansas's governor, Asa Hutchinson, because he was able to get them to clarify it before he signed the bill. But nonetheless, these were two very significant bills. They're not the only big pieces of conservative legislation, though, that have gotten through. Kansas has passed some restrictions on how welfare money can be spent. It's actually very specific on all the things you cannot spend welfare dollars on, movies, tattoos, gambling, et cetera. Oklahoma passed a second trimester abortion ban. So I guess what I'm kind of getting at is Democrats who might be upset by this, I mean, they'd kind of better get used to it because there's a Republican lock on a lot of these state governments, isn't there? I mean, the Democrats kind of in Texas and Wisconsin, where all they can do is kind of like flee and try to prevent a quorum from happening, right, Molly?
It's 69 legislative bodies in the United States right now are controlled by Republicans. So that's a huge amount. And I think it's something like half the states have passed, or not passed, introduced bills regulating abortion. There's 100 different bills right now under debate or in, the legislative committees in states doing things like some of them are like the trimester bills that are actually limiting what kinds of abortions you can have. Some of them are parental notification laws, waiting periods, watching a video before you go in to get a procedure. So these are getting passed all over the country and moving through the state houses. And I think you're right. I think, the Democrats have a very weak showing in a lot of these states. There's not a lot going into the bench for the Democrats, who's really challenging these governors. I think there's 31 Republican governors right now, and they're all pretty safe. So I think, we're going to see a lot of this kind of conservative legislation coming through. And things like the religious freedom bills, those get a lot of pushback in states like Indiana, but in other states they might not get the same backlash.
Carson, I mean, this has been the result of decades-long, really, investment by Republicans in pursuing state house control. Do Democrats have anything like it, or are they?
They're playing catch-up right now.
Yeah.
They are now just starting to realize what the Republicans have been doing for a decade and a half of building local candidates to run for the state houses, to then run for governor or the other offices in the state. This isn't just something that happened in 2010. This is something that has been in the works for a very long time, and now they're reaping the benefits of all the time and energy they put into it. But this goes to show you, the polarization of the country, that, the people aren't splitting ticket really anymore, especially when you get down ballot. It shows that, really one-party rule in a state isn't necessarily the best thing, whether it's Democratic or Republican. You need the combating of opinions and ideas, the debate, the legislative system to really function. You need at least two parties.
This is kind of a fact out of left field, I guess, because I stumbled across this in doing some research for something completely different today. But it was a research analyst who was saying that economic growth in like towns, I don't know if he took it to a state level, cities, was stronger in areas that had, more equal party control. And it had probably to do with the competition, the different ideas that were injected in there, switching out, the occasional corruption that kind of rises when you have too much.
San Francisco, then.
Tech.
Of left and really left?
Yeah, okay. Well, I said it was, yes. all the difference from A to B, or all, yeah.
What? Part of the problem too is, and I, as maybe a member of the lamestream media, part of the problem too is people rarely know who their representatives are. The debate on the basic level. I talk to community groups all the time. People think Gavin Newsom is the mayor. You know, like a lot of people aren't paying attention to these local races, and then you sort of aggregate it, and then all of a sudden, what? We have what law? How many people in Indiana were like, wait a minute, what did you guys just do? Because people aren't paying attention. There just is not being covered enough, and it's not as glamorous, of course. It doesn't have a C-SPAN. It doesn't have, 20 Sunday talking head shows to discuss these important local issues. So that when you remove that kind of local engagement and you leave it to the diehards who are just committed to finding any way they can to make inroads on Roe v. Wade, for example, that becomes a problem. And look, and Republicans in California are just as disgusted as what we're doing here, with our own cap and trade program and our own foreign policy with China, basically. So, we sort of take these things upon ourselves, and states do this, especially when they feel frustrated by the federal government, which everyone does. But so there's two things working. It's not only have we become less engaged locally, but we become more frustrated as states. The people who are paying attention are increasingly frustrated with what the federal government is doing. So this, we get this unholy marriage of just these crazy experiments that are happening in the different states, and you're just kind of passing it, hoping no one will notice. And then sometimes they do, and then you get the case in Indiana. But 99% of the time, they don't. And the next thing you've got a heartbeat abortion bill, which would prevent abortions after 6 weeks in Oklahoma. And that's the kind of thing that gets done when no one's paying attention.
Carson, I thought it was interesting that the effective blowback for the Indiana and Arkansas laws didn't really come from Democrats. They were bystanders in this whole thing. But it came from private business, big business, which, of course, tends to go Republican. And that's where they put their money, too, in campaigns. I think that probably says a lot, as we've mentioned, both about the state of Democrats in a lot of state houses, but also big business. And does this mean anything? Is this something Democrats can maybe look at and build new coalitions? Or does it mean actually on the Republican side that it might buffer up a bit of the old, more moderate wing of the Republicans, as much as it might still exist, because they see now they can build alliances with business? I mean, what does it say?
You've been seeing, and 2014 was, I think, a big year for this electorally as well, is that the establishment, although I hate that word, establishment, what does that mean? But the business-minded branch of the Republican group is starting to fight back. They realize that the party has been kind of being taken from them in a certain respect, and they're not going to just sit back and let it happen. So you saw them, starting to fund their own PACs, funding their own candidates, really being very vocal on issues that they find it to be important or conversely detrimental to the movement. And this is a fantastic example of them really wielding their influence in a positive manner, I think. And with great results. I mean, they were able to get the state legislature and the governor to backpedal almost immediately. And for someone who pays attention to legislative making, nothing happens within a week or 2 weeks. That bill itself had taken months to draft and work through the committees, and all of a sudden they were able to get a fix done in just a matter of days. That's pretty impressive. There's a lot of people in Sacramento who would love to see that sort of progress happen.
Yes. Actually, talking about the old line Republicans and the activist Republicans and all that reminds me, actually, we have a very interesting program coming up here. I think if you come to week, you kind of like getting a mix of views. Grover Norquist is going to be here. And he recently, I guess in his new book, was talking about, he's basically blaming Obama's control of the IRS for getting reelected in 2012 because it supposedly inhibited the conservative group. So I'm sure he'll be asked about that. So April 21st, right here in these same comfortable seats, you can ask him your questions. Let's move on to more of a mixture of political news. And I wanted to start with you, Melissa, because you recently had something on this on CBS San Francisco, and that is what was called the Sodomite Suppression Act and the response. So why don't you tell us
you
about this?
You guys have heard of this, right? Yes, okay, so...
why is he asking her about that?
The word sodomite, just what? So some horrible person, a lawyer, of course.
A lawyer.
Of course, my people. The California bar is difficult. I don't know how this happened. But apparently he made it. He's a lawyer. And he's down in, like, Huntington Beach, and he puts this thing on the ballot, or at least he submits it. He submits, Sodomite Suppression Act. Basically says, anybody who advocates homosexuality, who touches another person of the same sex for the purposes of sexual gratification, should be killed, right? It's an execution. It's a ballot measure. And here's the problem with the ballot measure, because anybody, this is what this is exposing, anyone with, like, a crayon and $200... can submit it. And if you submit it, then the state attorney general has to write a title and summary for your submission. And also, I believe it's the treasurer, maybe the controller, has to do a financial analysis of the impact of your submission. And Kamala Harris was like, wait. I do not wish to summarize this horrible, horrible thing. So she actually filed a lawsuit to get herself out of this legal obligation that she has to do this, because there's really no exemption in the law for really horrible, horrible stuff, right? So she's kind of gone to a judge and been like, please get me out of this. I'm running for Senate, and it would be really good if I did not have to touch this. Now, she may lose, and that's that because, again, there's no actual exception in the law that requires this, although there may be. It may be in 2 weeks, depending on, that may be something we can get through quickly. But at the very least, it's political cover, right? At the very least, it is, she can say, well, they made me do it, right? I tried, I went to court, a judge forced me to write this summary and title for this truly horrible thing. Now, of course, it has to go get signatures. She's writing the title and summary as the official thing on the clipboard that they give you outside of the grocery store. That's the thing. And then it has to go get signatures, which it won't. Okay. But in the meantime, there was, what's it called, the idiot?
I'll let you read it.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, the Intolerant Jackass Act has also been submitted, and it would require anyone who puts something on the ballot that requires homosexuals to be murdered to go through sensitivity training and donate $5,000 and donate $5,000 to an LGBT charity. That one will totally pass, by the way. I think that it will. The Intolerant Jackass Act. Sort of. So we're kind of using the system against each other, but that's, politics is such a fascinating thing, especially when it intersects with law. And so, but it does expose this issue because there really is no bar. Anyone with $200 can file any insane thing that they want and go out and try to get signatures for it. And so it's kind of a frightening thing if you think about it. But the problem is, how do you draw lines around it? I mean, you could say something really basic, like you cannot advocate for the murder of anyone. But then what happens if somebody wants, a death penalty statute? There's all sorts of permutations on this. So this debate over how do you get stuff on the ballot and how high of a hurdle should it be is one that this is sort of bringing up. So this is something that we may see, a law on. We may see some additional maneuverings on. But look for that. And look for someone with a clipboard carrying the Intolerant Jackass Act outside of Ralph's. Totally sign that.
What do you think? Could this spur reform of the referendum process?
I mean, I think it's great that people are learning that this is a thing. I had no idea this is a thing until...
Really?
Anyone could submit something and that they had to put it out there. That's kind of crazy. So at least it's raising awareness of that. And, again, showing that this is a ridiculous position to have. But yeah. He covered it.
I mean, there are some serious reforms that could not necessarily prevent a ballot proposition like this to be submitted, but to kind of stop it before it would ever get to the qualification signature standpoint. I mean, you could take the title summary writing power out of a political office altogether. I mean, that would help in a lot of different situations also, where you have a partisan person writing titles and summaries that then are put onto the ballot. I mean, so there could be some, you know, tricky things going on there. And you've seen that happen before with Republican attorney generals and Democrats. I mean, you could have a Supreme Court review just doing kind of a very basic, is this by any measure constitutional at all? Not really an in-depth look at it, but just can this go, you know, forward sort of review, which would definitely catch something like this immediately. I mean, the judges would definitely catch it. You could allow the legislature to get involved prior to propositions going to the signature process. That allows them to either pass it or not pass it. Getting them involved in some manner could actually help the legislature's approval ratings also a little bit, but who knows. So there are some things that could be happening. It's a matter of whether anyone in Sacramento decides to use this as a learning opportunity. And, well, it's Sacramento, so who knows.
Well, before we get to some more questions from the audience, any thoughts on, did you see the story about Apple, it's building its giant new spaceship office building down in the peninsula? It's shaped like a... a donut. I think it's shaped like a spaceship, but whatever. They kind of got some bad news, by meaning bad news coverage, when it was reported that they had prevented any felons from working on the construction. And then very quickly, after that news came out, they changed that. Molly, do you have any thoughts on I mean, talk about someone kind of making a switch pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that was immediate. The reports came out one day, and the next day they had changed the policy. And, you know, you think about it, if you can't work construction as an ex-felon, what can you work? You know, what kind of jobs will you get hired in? And, you know, California does have, it's known as ban the box rules, or some places call it fair chance rules, where it's illegal for employers to ask about convictions on the initial application. I believe the statewide law in California only applies to state employees. But San Francisco, the law here is private and state, or city. So they can ask in later stages, and if it's a rule that really would, you know, you couldn't have, you know, someone who had been convicted for, you know, some sort of sexual charge being in a school or something like that. But for cases like this where it's, you know, ex-felons who, you know, might have drug charges on their record, it does give them a fair chance of being hired instead of getting thrown out in the initial stage. And there's been studies done that show that there's like 70 million people in the United States that have prior convictions or arrests on their record. So this really is a huge percentage of the population that has their employment limited. And so I think 15 states now have implemented either legislation or executive orders putting in place these ban-the-box policies, hundreds of cities, and it's something that really is bipartisan. I think like half the governors that have passed it have been Republicans. Chris Christie implemented it in New Jersey, Nathan Deal in Georgia. So this really is an issue that crosses party lines.
What California does have is something called negligent hiring, and that's basically a tort. That's a lawsuit that you can bring. If I'm working construction next to someone, and that person is swinging an axe or, you know, whatever you do on a construction site, you know, and they injure me and they hurt me, they attack me, and I find out that on the job application that person had been convicted of some sort of violent assault, and the employer knew it, put them next to me, sort of on the line, and now I'm injured. I'm going to sue the employer for negligent hiring. And that is the people, oh, employers are so evil. They're not. They're not mean. They're not trying to, like, get rid of everybody who's been to jail. But they're afraid of being sued for things like negligent hiring. There's also a tort called negligent retention, which is if you find out and then you retain the person even after they've been convicted, you can be sued as well. And so there's a real issue of liability. And so you understand why some employers want to have rules. Having said that, a blanket rule saying no felons it's crazy, right? You can have a felony DUI. Like, what the hell does that have to do with working at a construction site or hurting anyone? So you're certainly not putting anyone else in danger or putting the employer at risk. So, I mean, I saw sort of where they were coming from with it, but it was fair that they reined in. I assure you, they're still not letting murderers on their site. They're just doing an individualized review of each felony. And so if it is something like a drug possession or a DUI or something like that, that is something that's going to be different from if you're a violent felon. That's, you know, the problem there is the liability that you pose to the employer going forward if you harm a coworker or a customer or something like that. And so I think that that's going to remain on the books, even for Apple at that point. But that's why the rules are there, and that's why employers try sometimes to do that. Obviously, they went overbroad here.
Well, let's try to run through some questions quickly here before we get to the news quiz. We could do an entire hour on this program, this question, so I'll just ask for, however, some brief responses. Among the Republicans, I'll say, declared or not, who could present the greatest challenge to Hillary Clinton? Carson.
I would say Rubio, Bush. Rubio, Bush. Walker, maybe. I have to kind of see how he does on a national level, but...
along well with dogs.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah.
He's allergic to them. Yeah.
Yeah. That's yeah.
Really, really badly allergic to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which would be a first.
Hillary will buy him a dog. Molly.
I think Jeb Bush. I feel it's going to be Bush versus Clinton.
I agree. Bush and then Walker.
Okay. Who is, again, this is so far ahead, but it's fun. Who is a likely VP candidate? And do Democrat and Republican, if you would. It's the voice of the people. I just ask the questions.
You know, on the Republican side, I think Nevada's Brian Sandoval should be on any of their short list.
And that is?
He's the governor of Nevada, Hispanic, just a really bright guy, doing a lot of very interesting things in Nevada, especially on education. He should be on their short list by definitely. The Democrat side, I mean, Hillary needs someone young. So she needs to find someone who is a young senator, a young governor, someone who really could tie that I'm really moving into the future sort of kind of message.
A Rubio, for example.
Yes, yeah, exactly, yeah. That would be if actually, you know, She would definitely win in that case.
Yes. Molly, some names?
You know, Carly Fiorina, I think, will be one that gets tossed around a lot out there as a contender. And Rubio, I think, depending on how brutal the primary gets on the Republican side, you know, I think him and Jeb Bush are kind of a natural pair in a lot of ways. Democratic side, it's tough to say. You know, I could see someone like Martin O'Malley, maybe. He's going to run, but he's... former governor of Maryland, and he's, you know, on the younger side, and I could see him being a Hillary's second-hand choice.
Okay, Melissa?
I just want to point out that, legally speaking, Hillary could be her own vice president. I'm just saying. No, I'm just kidding. There's no rule that you have to have a separate person to be your vice president. No, on the Republican side, you're totally right. Carly Fiorina has been running for this. I mean, people look at her and they go, why are you running for president? It's bananas. Because she's not. She's running for vice president. She's a woman. She can be an attack dog. She can say all the things that the white dude can't say. She can get in there and say. So I think she's definitely trying for that. So I think she'll be on a lot of short lists. From a Democratic side aside, from herself or Bill, maybe a Raul Castro would be somebody she would be looking at as well. He's young, very popular, and I think would do her a lot of good. And, of course, Martin O'Malley has to be part of it. He was at the California Democratic Convention a couple of years ago, just gave a really fiery speech, even then was clearly running for a vice president. So, you know, we could do a lot worse, I think, on the Democratic ticket than a Martin O'Malley as well.
Okay, you heard it. It's going to be one of those folks in each party.
One of the 20 folks.
Yes.
Listed.
Well, let's go to our news quiz now. And is Fran going to be my chocolate deliverer?
Yay.
Okay, for those of you who have not been here before when we do this, I'm going to ask a news quiz question. If you think you know, raise your hand. I'll call on you. I did. I tested them with it.
You're going to be better than us.
Okay. If you get it right, then Fran will deliver your prize. Let's start with this one. A man committed suicide outside what government building this past weekend? Sir. That's right, the U.S. Capitol. Very good. Here's one of my favorite news stories. Following a deadly fight in an Arizona Walmart parking lot, whom did police take into custody? Ma'am, back there. A Christian band, that is correct. It's kind of like the Partridge Family gone very, very, very wrong. Yes.
Awful and tragic, tragic. And
it's great. Awful, awful. Okay. The FBI has started investigating what at San Francisco's jails? Sorry, I saw that hand first. Yes, sir. Exactly. The so-called gladiator fighting. Yeah. You guys are good. You guys, better than them. Seriously. I love you guys, but I'm just got to be honest. Okay. Why were 10 California sheriff deputies suspended? Yes. That's right. It was videotaped them catching a guy on a horse and... Very good. They beat up a guy. Why did Turkey recall its ambassador to the Vatican? Sir, again. Sorry? That's right. In Turkey, they do not recognize the Armenian genocide as genocide, and the Pope went there. So, very good. Two-time winner back there. But wait a minute. That's not our only Vatican ambassador question. The Vatican rejected the openly gay ambassador from what country? And, sir, that's right, France. You guys are good. Do I have anything here that will stump you? What Nobel Peace Prize, excuse me, not Peace Prize, what Nobel Prize-winning German author died this week at the age of 87? Günter Grass, that's right. Gentleman there again. Okay, just a couple more. This one you won't get. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy and the current French and German foreign ministers all made an unusual, not forbidden, but unusual public show of support for what this week? And it has to do with something that happened here in the U.S. that we talked about today. Anybody? Do you want to make a guess? Sorry? Nobody?
I'll guess it has to do with Indiana and Paris.
No. Good guess, though, but no. Nope, that wasn't a guess. Okay. They expressed support for Hillary Clinton's presidential race. Not generally done. Let's do one more. Let's find a happy one. Here's a good one. Let's go back to Nobel Peace Prize. What Nobel Peace Prize winner just had an asteroid named after her? Nobody? Were you going to guess? Who said Malala? You got it correct. That's correct. Malala just had an asteroid named after her, and yes, I think that's very cool. Well, we're going to have more news quiz questions and, of course, a lot more to talk about in two more weeks right here at the Commonwealth Club on Monday, April 27th. Thank you to our panel, Molly Riley, Melissa Griffin-Kane, and Carson Bruno. Thanks to all of you here listening online and watching on TV. Have a great week, and I'll see you next time.